Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We will be back next week with all new show to kick off 2020. But in the meantime, we want to re-air some of the best progressive candidate interviews from 2019. These are candidates challenging stale incumbents in congressional seats all around the country and a senatorial one as well. We hope you'll take the time to learn more about each candidate and their issues. Let's listen to this. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We're continuing our interview series with progressive candidates from across the country. This week, we feature Kara Eastman. She's running for Congress in Nebraska's 2nd District again. So, Kara, let's just start. Tell us a little bit about the 2nd District of Nebraska. This, and we should say, this is, you know, we've been doing a series of interviews with candidates who are running in the Democratic primary, who are running against Democratic incumbents. In this situation, to the extent that there is an incumbent, I guess, on some level, you're the incumbent. This is you ran last time to take on a Republican sitting congressperson. You came incredibly close, and we'll get more into, you know, some of the reasons I've heard that, you know, the challenges that you faced in this district. But first, let's just start with you telling us a little bit about the 2nd District in Nebraska.
Sure. Well, so the 2nd District encompasses Omaha and the county that Omaha's in, which is Douglas County, and a little bit of the county to the south of us, which was gerrymandered in 2010 and unfortunately is less of a Democratic stronghold than it should be. So I ran in 2018, I actually won Douglas County, but lost Sarpy County, the part of the Sarpy County that's in the 2nd District.
And you say when you say you ran, that was in the general election.
Correct. Yes. So we had a primary last year, and part of the reason why we got a lot of attention is because I beat a former incumbent Democrat. He was in Congress for one term from 2014 to 2016. Lost the election in 2016 to a Republican, ran again, and I beat him in the primary by 3.3%.
I mean, you were, I think, objectively speaking, one of the most reported on primary candidates at the time because of that dynamic and because you are running a, I don't know how to best to characterize it, but a completely full-throated, full-on to the left campaign in terms of your support of various issues. I mean, how much but for folks who weren't following that story in 2018, at least in terms of the primary, tell us, like, you know, what was involved in that? Because you have shown up in a lot of pretty big, important reported pieces, particularly about the dynamic with the DCCC. But tell us about that primary and why you had received such attention.
Right. Well, I figured it's just because I'm such a phenomenal candidate and that's why I've been getting so much attention. But sure, there are all those other reasons, too. So basically what happened was, you know, the DCCC supported and backed my primary opponent in 2018 because he had been an incumbent. And we were not necessarily then predicted to win. And once we did win, and my task, you know, I've always been looking to unseat the Republican incumbent. I wasn't intending on having a primary opponent. I had actually reached out to the former congressperson who told me he probably wasn't going to be running again, but he changed his mind and decided to run. But when we beat him, it made national headlines because the DCCC hadn't supported me. They had supported him. They put him on their red to blue list. And so I think it was a little bit of a shock to the nation that somebody who, you know, from for all intents and purposes, had come out of nowhere, beat this former incumbent Democrat.
And just tell us about this. And I want to talk about the general election. Then we'll talk more about the issues that you support and what you're looking at for this primary. But in terms of the partisan index, as they call it, like, how Democratic is the 2nd District? Because and I ask this, I mean, it's obviously relevant in terms of the general, but it's also relevant in terms of the primary because of what we now know, at least from the data coming out of 2018, as to what it takes to win in certain types of districts. And so what can you tell us about the sort of the political makeup of the 2nd District?
Well, we are pretty split when it comes to Democrat versus Republican. I think what's interesting about the district is we are a quarter registered independents. And we, you know, this area, I think when people, you know, outside of Nebraska think of Nebraska, they think of rural areas. It's, this district is 98% urban. We're 12% African-American, 10% Latino. We have a large refugee population, actually the largest South Sudanese refugee population outside of South Sudan. So it's an interesting, diverse district. And I think the conventional wisdom had been, and maybe even still is, that you have to be a conservative Democrat to win, which, you know, we only have evidence that a conservative Democrat could win by that one case of somebody winning in 2014, but losing in 2016. So the person that I ran against in the primary, or technically ran against me, was a blue dog Democrat, somebody that was considered more conservative. But what's interesting about the district is that the when we look at polling, when we look at public opinion, the platform that I'm running on, the policies that I support are vastly they're supported by a vast majority of people. Most people think that we need to do something about climate change, that people deserve a livable wage, that we need to fix and expand healthcare. So it's always interesting to me when people kind of peg a candidate as far left or far right. Like, I see my candidacy and my platform as being much more mainstream because it's widely supported by so many people.
Well, what's interesting, and earlier this week on my other show, The Majority Report, I interviewed a statistician and a pollster who, by all accounts, was the made the earliest prediction about the 2018 election, and almost down to the numbers of Democratic pickups had made that prediction 4 months out, way before anybody else had. And she said that because, and she has this idea of a new paradigm that she has, that districts like yours and ones that are even more Republican than yours, that because the electorate is so polarized, that even the independents already predetermined who they lean towards in terms of parties. They either lean Republican or they lean Democrat. And that the key to these type of elections is mobilization of people who already agree with you. And that that is very much driven by a negative partisanship. And in fact, the vast majority of people who won in these contested races were people who made sharp distinctions with their Republican challenger, and that the blue dog Democrats lost in 2018. And in fact, she cited you specifically as one of the rare cases where someone with your politics would lose, but that was more of a function of the DCCC afraid on some level that you would be a proof of concept of what happens when you run on these progressive populist issues in a you know, purplish district. And so I'm fascinated about by this. And obviously it has big implications going forward. And I think people, you know, want to know why they should be supporting you on the second attempt to you to do this. And you lost by an incredibly small amount, didn't you, in the general election?
Yes, by 1.9%. It was one of the closest races in the country.
All right. Well, this is what I want to do is I want to take a break here. And when we come back, let's talk about those policies and talk about the candidates that you're running against in the primary, because there is really, you know, there's two things here. There's one, do people subscribe to your vision for what we should have in this country? And obviously your constituents similarly. And also, what is going to prove to be the winning formula in this district? So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Kara Eastman. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with progressive candidate from Nebraska, Kara Eastman. So, Kara, in the last segment, you told us a little bit about the second congressional district in Nebraska. You told us about your unexpected primary win last year, or at least it was unexpected by the conventional wisdom folk, and you defeated a candidate who was being actively supported by the DCCC in the primary, and you defeated that candidate, and with, by all accounts, and you can tell me if I'm wrong here, the DCCC, and, you know, people, I guess, could argue as to why they were motivated to do so, They gave you virtually no support. To the extent that they gave you any support, it was completely anemic. And you lost by what you told me was the smallest margin of a loss in all of 2018. And one can only imagine, had they supported you significantly or even remotely, how big your margin of victory would have been in that instance. But you tell me if I'm wrong. Did you get in that general election, do you feel like you got the full support of the DCCC?
No, and we know now that we didn't. They actually pulled an ad buy a couple of weeks prior to the election. So, and we know that those ads can actually move the needle 1 or 2 points. So yes, had they come in and fully supported my candidacy, we might be having a different conversation right now.
And as I said in the last segment, that the data shows that folks like yourself were more likely to win these races in 2018 than Blue Dog Democrats. So tell us about the proposals that you are pitching to constituents in Nebraska's 2nd District.
Well, one of the ways that we won the primary and did so well in the general is by knocking on doors. We knocked on over 200,000 doors, and we learned a lot from doing that. And the number one issue for people here is healthcare, and that continues to be the same as we knock on doors now. So I believe, you know, right now I think we're in a bit of a healthcare crisis as the Republican Party is basically threatening to take away healthcare from millions of Americans. And so we need to save our healthcare system. But I have supported expanding healthcare so that everybody in the United States has coverage. I decided to run because of my mother's own prescription drug costs. And I meet people every day who share those very similar stories to me of how they're having to choose between prescription medication and putting food on the table for their family. So this is the number one issue here. I think it's probably the number one issue for people across the country. And we need people who are going to put out bold solutions to solve our healthcare issue.
All right. So healthcare is up there. And give us a sense of where you are on climate change.
So I ran a children's environmental health organization for 13 years here in Omaha called Omaha Healthy Kids Alliance. And our focus was safe, energy efficient, healthy housing. So I've seen firsthand the impact that creating an energy efficient home has for people living in poverty, for middle class working families, because they pay such a proportionately larger amount of their income for their utility bills than the rest of America. So we need absolutely bold solutions for climate change right now to deal with the pollution that's happening. In Nebraska, we're seeing this with flooding. And just the devastation that's occurring around the world, which then impacts things like immigration, which impacts things like our economy. So for me, this is one of those issues where, you know, I think climate change is the number one moral issue facing our kids. We're leaving this issue for them to clean up. And it's time for policymakers to stand up and take bold action, because we don't have time. We know that we don't have time to wait on this.
So where are you on something like the Green New Deal?
So the Green New Deal has become, the Republicans have been able to twist and turn this around and say ridiculous stuff like candidates who support this support banning airplanes or meat, which is just silly. But I think the fact that we have a bold idea out there, and it's not a formal policy, it's a plan, but I think there's a lot of stuff in there that makes so much sense for moving the country forward and actually getting us to a place where we can say that we are having a positive impact on climate change instead of contributing to the further deterioration of our planet.
What are other issues that you're finding that folks in the second district are interested in?
For us here, you know, jobs and the economy are important. So while we keep hearing that the economy is doing so well and unemployment is so low, that is true for a percentage of people, but there are a number of people here who are still working 2 or 3 jobs, who don't have access to high quality, high paying jobs. Transportation is an issue here. So making sure that we're participating in an economy that continues to grow for everybody, not just for people who are already well off. I think that's a major issue. And the reality is right now, corruption in politics comes up a lot. It comes up at the doors. It comes up when I meet people on the streets, because they're worried about the way that it, you know, just the stuff that's happening in the White House. And you know, it's fascinating to me that what we'll hear people say is like, oh, well, politicians have always been corrupt, so what Trump is doing is nothing new. But to me, he is decimating our democracy. He's decimating our global standing. And I'm concerned about the future of what we are allowing a president to get away with. We need politicians who are refusing corporate PAC money like myself, because we have to get money out of politics. There are steps that we need to take to make sure that we have a functioning republic and that our democracy and our elections are not interfered with by foreign entities. So there is a lot of stuff to work with under that corruption umbrella. Mm. But we need candidates who are actually going to stand up and say what's happening right now is just not OK in the United States of America.
Tell me about your perspective on impeachment. I mean, it's quite possible that by the time, if you do get through the primary and you head into the general election, you will be facing an incumbent, a Republican incumbent, who has voted to not hold Donald Trump accountable. Your perspective on that.
Yeah, and not just not hold him accountable. I mean, he endorsed, you know, my opponent endorsed Trump out of the gate and stands with him, votes with him 97% of the time, and basically has signed a pledge saying he won't disagree with him. So he will never support impeachment of this president. And after reading the Mueller report, I supported impeachment then because from reading it, it seemed like we had clear evidence that the president had committed impeachable offenses. And now we clearly see this happening, that you can't let a president get away with inviting foreign governments to interfere in our election, no matter what. This is like the foundation of our democracy. And if we let this president get away with this, then what are we saying to future presidents? What are we saying to future candidates that we're tolerating something that is so unthinkable? And I think we've almost become numb to this. Like every day something else comes out and it just doesn't even seem like that big of a deal anymore. I actually had a high school student say to me, well, do you just support impeachment because you don't think any of the Democratic candidates who are running for president are qualified to beat him? And I said, this to me is not about removing President Trump from office. This is about saving America.
Right. All right. So we just have about 30 seconds or more. What are you looking for folks right now in your fight? You're in this primary. You have a couple other challenges, I think about three. I don't think that any of them you could really say are to the left of where you're at in that respect. What are you looking for in terms of support from folks who are listening to this interview?
Right. Well, I mean, in the primary, we are the clear front runner based on our fundraising numbers, based on our poll, which we actually just got back that has me far outperforming them. But more importantly, we just have a lot of enthusiasm and support from people within the district. People are excited that I'm running again. And in terms of support, we always need volunteers. We need people to follow us on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And obviously, as all candidates right now need is financial donations. So my website's eastmanforcongress.com. Easy to find, very Googleable, but welcome any help from anyone, anywhere, as long as our values align and you're not a corporate PAC.
All right. Well, we don't have too many corporate PACs listening to the show these days. Kara Eastman, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it and good luck.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Kara Eastman is running for Congress in Nebraska's 2nd District. You can find out more about Kara's campaign over at eastmanforcongress.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. We're continuing our interview series with progressive candidates challenging incumbents across the country. This week, we feature Albert Lee, running to unseat Earl Blumenauer in Portland's 3rd District. So, Albert, let's first start with you tell us a little something about the 3rd District of Oregon.
Yeah, sure. Well, the 3rd District is one of 5 districts here in the state of Oregon. Is actually the most compact district. It is comprised of a little bit of northwest and southwest Portland, and then all of Portland east of the Willamette River, and then the majority of Multnomah County, or the entirety of Multnomah County, all the way out to Mount Hood. It also includes parts of northern Clackamas County, except for a couple of suburbs, including Milwaukee, Happy Valley, parts of Happy Valley, and Oregon City. It is a fairly urban district with a little bit of rural on the east side.
And give me a sense of the folks who live in the 3rd District and more or less like, you know, what they're looking for from your perspective from a congressperson.
Sure. So the 3rd District is, I would say, one of the most progressive districts in all of the country. We have had a representative here for, well, over 23 years, and he is seeking a 24th and a 25th year in Congress. What the folks of the 3rd District want is a continuation of progressive initiatives, making sure that we take care of our planet, deal with some of the pressing problems that we have here currently, in looking at the homelessness issue that we have, the lack of living wages and affordable housing, and, of course, the climate emergency.
And, I mean, give me a sense. I mean, are we talking about a wealthy district? Are we talking about working class folks? What are the demographics of the district? Give us a sense of just who the folks are that you want to represent.
Sure. I think that, in generally speaking, you know, we got everyday Americans here in our district. We have folks that are white-collar professionals, but when we also have blue-collar working folks. We have a wide variety of folks. Now, when it comes to the demographics of the diversity of this district, we are the most diverse district in the state of Oregon, but that's not really saying a whole lot, because when you look at the city of Portland, it is known as the largest, whitest city in America, and I think that we're somewhere in the upper 70s when it comes to the population being white, and then the rest of it's kind of broken down into other folks, Hispanic, African-American, Asian, and Native American. But generally speaking, you know, these are solid arts people that are looking for things that are going to help make their everyday lives better. We have some pretty big issues here when it comes to the homelessness crisis, the lack of affordable housing and living wages, and the climate emergency. And I think that folks are really looking for some relief and some resolution of those questions. They're also looking for things that are going to take care of, you know, healthcare, that are going to take care of the issues that we have when it comes to criminal justice reform and, you know, basic human rights for everyone.
So, Albert, tell us a little bit about Earl Blumenauer. You mentioned that he's been there for, about 22 years, did you say?
23 years, almost a quarter of a century.
And yeah, okay, now that's a long time. And let me just say this, you know, there are, we are obviously having a series on people challenging Democrats. That range, and these incumbents range from fairly progressive ones to ones that are more conservative. And I am of the mind that primary challenges are an extremely healthy feature of our politics, particularly on the Democratic side, where there has been a tendency of Democrats to become complacent and to feel like they can ignore the left and the progressives and the populists because they have not been challenged. And so the exercise in and of itself is extremely healthy in my estimation. But Earl Blumenauer is a guy who I think most people perceive to be pretty progressive. Give me a sense of why you think this guy needs to be challenged.
Sure, absolutely. Well, first of all, he's been in office for 23 years. And during those 23 years, 12 cycles, he really hasn't faced any kind of a challenge. We are in a heavily Democratic district, a safe seat, if you will. I believe it is a plus 24 Democrats on the Cook Partisan Voting Index, which means that, yeah, it means that a Republican will never have a shot here. A third party candidate will never have a shot here. That means that we need to have Democratic primary challengers. Without that, you're not going to be able to hold your representatives accountable. People are not going to be engaged. And in general, your representative will become complacent, will start phoning it in. Now, Earl, you're right, is generally a decent progressive vote. In fact, he has spent the entirety of his time developing a very strong progressive brand. But you only need to scratch the surface to see that progressiveness isn't really aligned with the leftist thinking of this district. For instance, Earl is our climate change champion who happens to own over $3 million in fossil fuel stocks. And up until 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago, continued to take fossil fuel money. He most recently signed with the Sunrise Movement to stop taking additional fossil fuel funds. But for the last 23 years, he certainly did. Wow. Now, I remember you guys had a podcast earlier a couple weeks ago when you were talking about DaVita. I think it was AB 290 down in California, how they're trying to get rid of those companies that are doing the kidney dialysis. Well,
yep.
last cycle, DaVita was one of the largest donors to Earl's campaign. So again, someone who is looking to say that they are for single payer healthcare, Medicare for all, when you're taking money from funds and companies that are doing everything they can to profit on the current private health insurance regime that we have, that's not really being the progressive that we need. In addition, when you look at, I already talked about taking the fossil fuel money and being a climate change champ, taking healthcare money and being a single-payer healthcare champ, when it comes to a lot of the social issues, our congressman has been really slow to come to the right answers. So,
Albert. Hold that thought. We got to take a break here. I apologize. When we come back, let's hear what you have to say about Earl Blumenauer on those social issues. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Albert Lee. He is running for Congress in Oregon's 3rd District, challenging longtime Congressman Earl Blumenauer. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back. Back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking to progressive candidate Albert Lee. So, Albert, in the last segment, you basically outlined for us what the interests of the 3rd District are, and you were telling us why you are challenging Earl Blumenauer, who has been a longtime congressman for the Oregon's 3rd District, been around for almost 23 years, I guess. He has branded himself a progressive. In fact, I look at his website, and he very interestingly says that he's radically effective, which is an interesting way to market yourself. But yet, uh-huh. You tell us, you know, and I think you know this is also in many respects, I think the value of a challenge from the left. Here's a guy who has. Millions of dollars in stock portfolios of fossil fuels. He has accepted fossil fuel money for much of his career, although he has had a very late revelation, I guess, that you shouldn't take that money from the fossil fuels. You made the point that he takes money from a company that we've talked about in the past that has a dialysis monopoly, which is highly problematic when you're talking about healthcare in this country. And you were about to say that he is been a little bit late when it comes to progressive social issues. Which are those issues?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, going back to the Defense of Marriage Act, he voted for the Defense of Marriage Act, which said that marriage was between a man and a woman. Today, a lot of folks think of him as the LGBTQ champ. You know, when we look at other issues that revolve around things like this, Sesta Fosta is another good example. He voted for that. And what that does is it drives workers in the sex industry underground. It also drives children that are trafficked deeper into the recesses of the Internet where they cannot get help. And generally speaking, when it comes to a wide variety of different social issues, he waits until it is comfortable to get there. For me, it's not about Earl. It's about our future. It's about our planet. It's about our people. It's about our community. And for me, I've got a 6-year-old daughter. She needs a planet to live on, a stable country to live in, and a life worth living. And I cannot have faith in a representative that takes corporate money to do the right thing for the people, to do the right thing for the planet over profits. So that's my big issue. In addition to that, I think that democracy requires choice. And here in the 3rd District, we simply haven't had a legitimate choice in over a generation. Now, in the last 12 cycles, he has been challenged in the primary about 6 or 7 times.
Mm.
But each one of those primary challenges was from somebody who'd had no funds. And in fact, I believe that we've already raised more funds than all of his primary challengers have combined.
Wow.
So if you don't have a choice, if there's only one name on the ballot, it isn't really democracy.
Albert,
if we can't have. Yes.
Let me ask you this. So your theory of the case is that you're living in a very blue district. I think you said it was has a partisan index of something like a D24, which means that the Republican Party wouldn't put a nickel into that race because there's no way they're ever going to win it. So if that's the case, your theory of the case, it seems to me, is that Earl Blumenauer, instead of being someone who follows and comes late to a lot of these progressive issues, the congressperson from this district should be a leader on these issues because they are comfortably in a Democratic district. So let me ask you this. Why, tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, why is Albert Lee the right guy or person, I should say, to be the congressman of this very blue district?
Thank you. Yes. So the number one reason is because I know the struggle. I'm a 6th-generation American and an immigrant at the same time. I was born in South Korea, where my African-American Army dad met my Korean mom during the Vietnam War. Now, I had the opportunity of growing up in the 70s and 80s in North County, working class St. Louis, next door to Ferguson. And I got to tell you that back then, growing up back then, my sister and I, we weren't black enough. We weren't Asian enough. Folks couldn't figure us out, and that made them uncomfortable. And as a kid, I felt that. As I grew up, I grew to embrace all those things that made me different and unique. And I came to realize that actually none of us fit the neat little boxes that we're supposed to be in, and that those boxes divide us and hide us from the fact that deep down we're all truly the same on the inside. Now, coming from that background, coming from a working class background, I faced some serious issues. We had domestic violence in our household, which led to homelessness in a couple of different states. I know those struggles. Now, from a professional aspect, I'm a first generation college grad. I'm a first generation law school grad. I've worked in international trade. I've worked in law, legal industry. I've been, started my own business. And most recently, I was a dean for business and computing at Portland Community College. Now, I think that the combination of my professional experiences as well as my lived experiences provide me the wealth of knowledge to understand the people of the district, to understand their struggles, to know what it means to truly represent the people. Now, we are in a state where we have 7 representatives. That's 2 senators and 5 representatives. Now, 100% of them are over the age of 62. 100% of them are white. 100% of them are multimillionaires. And 5 out of 6 of them come out of from fairly wealthy elite backgrounds. And I don't think that that is representative of the people of the state of Oregon. And I think that it is important that our representatives are true representatives of the people instead of, this ruling elite class that creates this oligarchy that we have in Congress. I think that we need people who know the struggle in order to represent the people. And I think that I have those experiences, both life experiences and professional experiences, that make me the person most suitable to represent the people of the 3rd District.
Well, we have about 40 seconds left here, Albert. What is it that you're looking for folks out there in terms of this campaign, and when is the election?
Sure. So the primary is on March 19th, and that's where it gets decided. Come November, it is going to be the Democrat who wins because, again, we are in a D24 district. So I'm I've got the next 9 months basically to provide an education campaign, talk about folks, let them know where the shortcomings are for our current incumbent, but also let them know what our future can be, where we can move forward and how we can resolve some of these most pressing issues, especially the three that I mentioned about homelessness, the lack of affordable housing, living wages, and the climate emergency. I'm looking for both the financial support as well as the volunteer support from folks who believe that it is time for a change, that it's time for some new leadership, that it is time that we, have true representatives for the people.
And where can people learn more, Albert?
And people can learn more at albertlee2020.com.
Great. Albert Lee, good luck in your campaign. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Albert Lee is running for Congress in Portland's 3rd District. You can find out more about Albert's campaign over at albertlee2020.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. We're continuing our interview series with progressive candidates from across the country. This week, we feature Rebecca Parson. She's primarying the centrist Democrat Derek Kilmer in Washington's 6th District. So, Rebecca, let's just start with the Washington's 6th District. Tell us about this district. What's the geography that's covered? Who are the folks that live there? And who's it been represented by for how long?
Yeah, the 6th Congressional District is the northwesternmost tip of Washington and the continental U.S. It includes Tacoma, which is about 40 minutes south of Seattle, as well as the Olympic Peninsula, which is a beautiful area that has the Olympic National Forest and Park in it. And so it's a beautiful district. It's very diverse in terms of having both urban and rural areas. It's safely blue. We haven't had a Republican representative in about 50 years. And it caucused, majority of the district caucused for Bernie. And it's a very safe blue district. It's working class. Our representative currently is the Democrat Representative Derek Kilmer. He's a centrist Democrat. He's chair of the New Democrats Coalition, which is a third-way centrist caucus in Congress. And he's also a member of the Problem Solvers, which is a caucus that actively works to defeat progressive priorities. They're funded by dark money and Republican billionaires. Now, needless to say, perhaps he doesn't support Medicare for All or the Green New Deal or any of the progressive housing policies that I'm fighting for, like national rent control and a massive investment in social housing.
Well, I got to tell you, Rebecca, I mean, we couldn't have a better example of a district if we wanted to explain to people why we're doing this series where we interview progressive candidates who are challenging longtime Democratic congresspeople, because you've got a district there that is solidly blue. It's been so almost as long as I've been alive. And you've got a congressperson who couldn't represent the obstacles to the Democrats getting progressive change done more than Kilmer. And so, this is exactly why we are doing these type of interviews. So, all right. So give us a little bit of sense of your background, because, when you talk about a district where, that went for Bernie Sanders and one which is solidly blue and one which has a Democratic congressman who is obviously working on maybe the sort of lackadaisical feelings that people have had there, or their sense that maybe the government can't work for them, or maybe just their, a lack of scrutiny on where this guy is. Give us a sense of your background first in terms of what has set you up to take on a sitting congressperson.
Yeah, well, my grandfather was a colonel in the U.S. Army. He spent his career in the Army, and then my dad spent his career in the U.S. Foreign Service, and I grew up moving around overseas because of my dad's job. But from both of them, especially my grandfather, every time we would visit on home leave, my grandparents retired in Virginia. My grandfather would talk about, you know, why he joined the Army, his oath that he took to the Constitution. It was very important to him that he took that oath to the Constitution and not the president, and to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And so I grew up hearing about that. I grew up with the idea of service. I didn't really know what I would go into. I didn't really think about politics, but after college, I worked with a group called the International Association of Genocide Scholars for a couple years. I presented a paper at their conference in Sarajevo. And while I was there, I got to visit Srebrenica, which was the site of a massacre of 5,000 people, a genocidal massacre during the Bosnian War. And while I was there, through my work and study with the Association of Genocide Scholars and then that visit, I learned a lot about what can happen, you know, the 10 stages of genocide. That's something that your viewers and listeners may have seen online. The stages that happen when you go through first vilifying a group of people, calling them vermin and disease and stuff like that. And so I've always had that in the back of my mind when I'm analyzing news events, and I see the way that Trump talks about immigrants, the caravan bringing in diseases, that kind of thing. So it really concerns me. Then I went to Guatemala and Mexico to study Spanish. I volunteered as a human rights observer with the Zapatistas, which are an indigenous group in southern Mexico, where they essentially run their own society within Mexico. The government pretty much leaves them alone. And it's amazing what I saw there. They run on a very democratic principles, like economic democracy and political democracy. And it was really inspiring to see the way they've raised the quality of life, the power that they've taken for themselves. And at the time, the Mexican government was funding paramilitary groups to threaten these Zapatista villages, and that's why they requested a foreign human rights observers like me. When I came back to the States, I did AmeriCorps. And then when I came to Washington State, got really involved here in activism and organizing. I was a co-leader of Indivisible Tacoma for a year and a half. And the Indivisible Guide, for anybody who's not familiar, it was started after Trump's election to help fight back against Trump's agenda and pressure our Congress people to take the policies we want them to take. And what I found through that is that Derek Kilmer would not budge. And I think that in Washington State, it's really bizarre. You know, we have a reputation of being progressive. Of course, you know, we don't always live up to that reputation, but we do have that reputation at least. And so it's pretty blue, but we have really, I would say, the only progressive member of Congress we have is Pramila Jayapal. And the rest of them are either Republicans or centrists like Derek Kilmer. And it's just so frustrating. You know, I'm a housing organizer as well. And I saw across the district, like, people are literally dying because they get evicted and they die of exposure on the streets. People dying of the opioid epidemic, which Derek Kilmer, my opponent, takes money from the people who manufactured that opioid epidemic, which is killing people in our district. And just on and on like that, I saw that he was really not serving the interests of the people, but rather the corporations whose money he takes.
I mean, it really is stunning. He takes money from Big Pharma. He takes money from health insurance companies, from real estate, Wall Street, fossil fuel companies. I mean, give me your sense. I mean, you've been at this now for several months. You've had really impressive fundraising numbers. And that, of course, is super important in terms of getting further support. I mean, that's just simply the way that this works. There are organizations out there that are looking to support progressives, but they need to see that there has been some success in terms of fundraising, because people want to support someone who has a good chance at winning. And I think that there is a broad consensus that you do have a chance of winning. And give me a sense, and I want to talk about the issues that you are advocating. And I'm looking at your website at Rebecca for WA for Washington.com. When you have a congressman who has the positions he has and has the funding he has and the affiliations he has, what do you find amongst the electorate as to why this guy is still in office?
It's really machine politics. You know, the guy who was before him, Norm Dix, was in office for 30 years. He was just, you know, very corporate centrist, very much like Derek Kilmer. When he decided to retire, he handpicked Derek Kilmer. The two of them had become friends over the years, said, you're my successor. And then nobody ran against Kilmer, and he just kind of breezed into office. And he's never had a serious challenge. there's always a Republican, but they never come close to beating him. And he's never had somebody really take him on the way I am right now. And I think it's really just machine politics. You know, anybody, they didn't want to ruin their career by running against him when he first, his first attempt at Congress when he won. And so I think that's really what it is. And a lot of people, you know, the progressives in the district are really fed up with Derek Kilmer and his policies, his corporate money that he takes, and just the way they won't listen. I mean, he does town halls. He has a, makes a good show of being in the district, but the way he shows up in the district is very telling. It's the Chamber of Commerce events. It's town halls where his staff picks who gets the mic and who gets to ask questions. And the few times when us progressives do get to ask questions, like a fellow DSA member asked him, he was answering a question about health care, and a fellow DSA member said something like, you take money, you've taken this much money from health insurance and big pharma. And Kilmer responded, I resent the implication. I'm like, if you resent the implication, then stop taking the money, guy. Come on. It's just, it's so frustrating. And then I think the progressives, you know, they are really ready for somebody else. And then for the people who are engaged and they vote and they want Medicare for all, you know, the Washington State Democratic Party platform is very progressive. It has single payer health care in it. And Derek Kilmer, in a way, I'm more of a Democrat than he is because I actually stick to the Democratic Party platform. And so, but the, you know, maybe moderate centrists who, you know, they vote Democratic, they want these policies. Like, everybody wants the Green New Deal. Nobody's against that. And they just don't know. They think that, well, he's a Democrat and I want these policies and he seems like a pretty nice guy, so he must be for the things I'm for. And so when me and my volunteers, we talk to people and tell them, well, actually, you know, did you know that he, you know, took $10,000 from Raytheon one year, went on these privately funded trips to Israel, and then the following year he co-sponsored a bill for Israeli defense, and the contract for that went to Raytheon. You know, you tell them these kinds of things, like, oh, I didn't know that. Like, right. Some people just don't know, and so you tell them, and they're open to being persuaded.
All right. Well, Rebecca Parsons, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk more about the issues you do support and what your game plan is to unseat a sitting Democratic congressperson. We know there's been a lot of pushback against challengers by the Democratic establishment, but the voters are pushing back on that pushback. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back with Rebecca Parsons after this. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to progressive candidate Rebecca Parsons. So, Rebecca, in the last segment, you walked us through the makeup, both the geographic and the sort of the demographic makeup of Washington's 6th District. You talked to us about the sitting Democratic representative, Derek Kilmer, who is a I don't know if he's specifically a member of Third Way. I don't think Third Way, I don't know if it even exists anymore, but he is basically a Third Way Democrat. This is a corporatized Democrat. His donors include big pharma, health insurance companies, real estate, Wall Street, fossil fuel companies. He is a member of the so-called Problem Solving Caucus, which I think is a caucus where he caucuses with Republicans to look for corporate solutions, essentially, to problems that rather than ones that directly address those needs of the people. And I'm looking at your website, RebeccaForWA.com, and your policies are all in line with what you would expect from people who were, organizing for Bernie and supportive of Bernie. When you look at this sort of the panoply, you have Green New Deal, you have housing. You said you were a housing activist, getting money out of politics. You talk about addiction treatment and education and health care and LGBTQIA rights, indigenous rights, labor rights. Well, give me a sense of like what you think is job one, day one of those different issue sets.
Yeah, definitely. So there would be three that, and that would be the top. The first one I'd start with would be the Green New Deal, because I think it's the most pressing existential threat. If we don't solve this, we won't be able to solve a lot of the other things. Just as a matter of all the people who will be displaced, the catastrophic effects that climate change will have if we don't take immediate drastic action. So the Green New Deal would be number one. We're having the impacts of climate change around my district. You know, where I live in Tacoma, we had a summer where we literally had ashes falling from the sky because of fires in other parts of the state and country that were traveling and then on the wind and then just literally raining ash on our sky like a post-apocalyptic movie. And then we have coastal tribes in my district that are being displaced. They're having to leave places where they have lived since time immemorial and leave behind these sacred, really precious, culturally precious places and move. We have also in Aberdeen, it's my district, that's where Kurt Cobain was from, in the poorer areas, in the low-income housing complexes, when the river floods, it sends sewage onto the sidewalks that people have to walk around. And Aberdeen being on the water with rising sea levels, that flooding is just going to keep getting worse if we don't take drastic action. And then the federal jobs guarantee that's part of the Green New Deal would hugely benefit my district as well. We don't have enough jobs here, and the jobs we do have, not enough of them are union wage living wage union jobs. So that would be huge to have the Green New Deal with the federal jobs guarantee. Number two would be single-payer Medicare for all, which would just have cascading benefits throughout the district, especially with addiction treatment, which we really need. You know, alcoholism and opioid addiction is a big issue across the district, rural and urban, no matter where you are. Somebody knows somebody who is addicted or they have died. And we have people literally dying waiting in line for treatment because they can't get in. You know, Grays Harbor County in my district, there isn't a single place you can go if you're on state health care. There's nowhere to go in the county where you can get treated. And the only place you can go is a few hours away. But if you're low income, many people who are low income and in that situation, they don't have a car, so they can't get to those places. And they just literally die waiting for treatment. And then the third one is housing. And I've signed on to the Homes Guarantee, which was created by a national coalition of housing organizers and researchers. And it calls for national federal rent control and a massive investment in public housing, building 12 million new units of social housing in the next 10 years.
Wow. All right. Well, I mean, that's impressive. And you clearly have thought this out and know these issues well. Give me a sense of what you think it's going to take to win a primary. Both in terms of volunteers, in terms of money, in terms of strategy, and who you need to reach in the district.
Yeah, we need to have a giant ground game. The district is very large, and so we need a lot of volunteers. We have great momentum with that already. Like, I have people every day contacting the campaign asking how they can help. But the more the better, so that we can have a strong ground game all across the district. You know, as somebody running against an incumbent, one thing that any incumbent always has is name recognition over a challenger. So we really need to build up the name recognition, let people know that the campaign is here and what we're running for. So part of that, obviously big part, is the ground game. Raising more money. I don't take any corporate PAC or lobbyist money. So raising more so that I can continue building my team, making sure that as I'm doing that, I'm paying people a living wage because I want my campaign to be living out our principles. And then just getting the message out there and doing interviews like this one so more people can hear about us.
You know, I got to tell you, I'm looking at your website, and which is Rebecca4WA.com. And it honestly is, and I've done a bunch of these interviews, it has the most comprehensive description of the issues that you support. It is incredibly succinct. And I also have got to say this, I haven't seen this on basically your call for help. And you see a lot of candidates where the first thing is, you know, here's where you donate. And instead, you have check boxes, knock on doors, make calls, send texts, host a fundraiser. And I have to say that's really impressive. I mean, how important, like you mentioned, you know, paying your campaign staff, and just, we got about 30 seconds here. How important is it that you run a campaign that is consistent with your values? I mean, it certainly looks like you're running an organizer's campaign.
Yeah, definitely. And it's critical to pay people a living wage. I don't want to run a campaign where I'm just talking out of one side of my mouth and I'm paying people nothing or exploiting them. Like, it really needs to be about living out our values. And so that's super important. And when people donate, you, I just want you to know, anybody listening, talking directly to you, if you give me like $5, that's what you can afford. It helps. It's awesome. And it goes towards paying my staff a living wage.
Rebecca Parsons, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
Rebecca Parsons is running for Congress in Washington State's 6th District. You can find out more about Rebecca's campaign over at RebeccaForWA.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We are continuing with our interview series with progressive candidates from across the country who are challenging longtime Democratic incumbents. This week, we feature Jose Caballero. However, this week, we learned that 10-term incumbent Susan Davis would not be seeking re-election. Here to discuss his race, Jose Caballero. So, Jose, let's just first start with the California's 53rd congressional district. What can you tell us about this district?
Absolutely. The California 53rd district in San Diego County is actually one of the most progressive districts in the entire county. It is actually the central portion of San Diego is actually the highest, one of the highest concentrations of Bernie donors. And actually, the 53rd actually turned out 48% for Bernie in the primary. The eastern northern portions of the district are very highly concentrated of veterans. And it is a community that is really underserved in our district. And then you also have the southern portion, the southeast portion of the district, which is a very high concentration of Latinos. So it's a very highly diverse district between all demographics, and it is highly progressive as well. So that's kind of the district in a nutshell.
Okay.
And it's actually the second most populous district as well in the entire state of California.
Oh, is that right? Wow. Okay. So that's that's obviously it's a big district. And the district is currently represented by Democrat Susan Davis. And I think when we scheduled this interview, you were going to be challenging her in the Democratic primary. That turns out to not be the case. What has happened?
Well, Susan Davis has decided to not seek re-election as of a few days ago, which was very shocking to a lot of people. But what I believe is that we've been pushing her on the issues of Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, education for all, student loan debt forgiveness, and bringing the troops home with dignity. And we've also been supporting impeachment hearing or inquiries as well. And we moved her on the Green New Deal with the help of the Sunrise Movement and 350 earlier this year. And then she was starting to get pressured by Medicare for All. So I believe that our pressure and the way the district is really shaking out, I think that they were afraid of being, you know, Joe Crowley and an AOC coming in and just taking the seat away from a sleeping Democrat. So I think they jumped ship. So people like Sarah Jacobs, who just announced recently, who is a oligarch, she is a billionaire as to the Qualcomm fortune, is now running for the seat after she just got defeated in the 49th district up north and now was shopping around for the 52nd district when Representative Scott Peters was thinking about running for mayor of San Diego. But he decided to not do that and stay in a seat. And now she has just jumped into this race, which I think it must be nice to have millions and millions of dollars to be able to just move around wherever you want to go.
That's convenient.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
very convenient. Very convenient.
So you've grown up in this district, is that right? For the most part?
Well, for the most part, I got here from when I served in the United States Navy in 2006. So since I was 20 years old, I've been in this district. Yes. So originally, I was from the state of Texas.
Well, and let's talk about. I mean, I don't generally go into people's backgrounds too much. I mean, it's relevant mm-hmm. to the extent mm-hmm. that you've had that folks have a set of life experiences that inform who they are today. Yours are pretty unique. And I mean, tell us about that, because it's a fascinating story.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, I grew up in the state of Texas, and it was actually interesting because when I was younger, up to the age of five, we actually grew up in with a little bit of affluence. You know, we had the pools, we had the tennis courts, we had a huge house. But my father was actually dealing drugs and money laundering. So all that money was ill-gotten. My mother eventually was like, you got to quit this. And he didn't. So she left. And then the law caught up to him and he went to federal prison, thus leaving my life for about 7 years at that point. Then we moved to a small town in Texas called Mineral Wells. It's like 12,000 people at the time, where we went from affluence to living in one house in my grandparents' home, spanning seven people, spanning three generations. And me, my sister, and my mother were living in one bedroom in that house. And what was interesting about that as well, it was also a very predominantly white town. So it really wasn't very nice to have Jose Caballero as your name because the schooling was very discriminatory. They didn't allow me to be gifted and talented. They didn't allow me to do any of those things. So even with all that, I still grew up conservative. And after I persevered through the discrimination, persevered through the education system, taking college classes while in high school to catch up to my peers, I was able to get into the nuclear engineering program for the United States Navy, where I served 6 years as a reactor operator. And then that's what brought me to San Diego. And once I started going to school and I actually took philosophy and understood what an actual valid argument was, that's when my conservativeness started to be challenged. And then I went independent. Then I went like diehard Democrat. And now I'm a progressive Bernie-crat. So it was a very, very long journey, but that arc did happen. And now, you know, since then, I've, you know, with my political science degree, I've been running campaigns across the county, even one in Connecticut. And then I am now a small business owner for a political consulting firm where we run field grassroots field campaigns for candidates across the county.
Wow. So, I mean, that is a fascinating story. That is incredibly varied and impressive as well. So let me ask you this. I mean, when you look at in this county and as you know, I think when people juxtapose your description of the county and your life experiences, it's quite clear, you know, how you match up with this incredibly diverse county. You said, you know, a huge, significant, you know, the highest concentration of Bernie contributors in 2016, but also a strong contingency of vets in the community, and Latinos. I mean, in some respects, it seems that you have shared experiences, or shared a perspective with just about, all of the major elements of this, community. I imagine this was one of the reasons why Susan Davis may have gotten a little bit nervous about running against you. Let's talk just a little bit about how you think those different experiences that you had, whether it was understanding, and obviously you're five, so you don't fully understand what's going on with your father at that time. But the idea of having your father go away and having to move with your mother and restart your life, being in a a fairly difficult environment in school where, kids can be cruel and certainly in terms of racial issues, that can be a problem. And then into the Navy, I'm just curious as to those different experiences that you had, you know, how did that shape you as you're going through there? And how do you think that addresses a lot of things that might exist in your community? We'll take a break soon, and then when we come back, we'll talk about specific issues. But I'm curious, just from a value set.
So from a value set, one thing that all the life experiences that I've had to fight for everything in my life. I've had to fight. I've had to prove myself. I've had to prove my intellect. I've had to prove my strength. I've had to basically go against the grain of everything that everybody was telling me. From the point from high school when they were telling me, you're either going to join the military or just going to go to community college or just get a job. No one's telling me to go to a four-year university, right? So it was me that went into the Navy and said, give me the hardest intellectual job that you've got. And I persevered and I fought for that. And it was very difficult going from mediocre schooling to one of the elite you know, military schools in the entire country, and having to persevere through that and making sure that I had to break through from the military, of dealing with the traumas and the abuse that the military is ingrained into the system itself, and having to develop a thick skin to be able to emotionally cope with people who don't have your best interests in mind and want to see you suffer. We having to persevere through and weather all of that, and then coming out of the military with that sharp edge that I had, which you know, most would say PTSD or transitional issues. I had to also persevere of coming back in the civilian life and being accepted again as another type of human, which is a veteran that has to deal with the traumas of an abuse that exists within the military structure, and coming back from that. Also losing two shipmates from suicide, you know, was another traumatic issue with me, because I have lost many and have had many conversations with veterans that I served with, people who have served that I did not serve with, that have been dealing with these issues for a long time, because we're losing 20 veterans a day in this country. And for me, knowing the deck plates, knowing the emotional traumas as enlisted, will allow me to give me a clear-eyed picture to talk to the vets. And one-fourth of all the homeless vets in San Diego are veterans. So that's another major issue. And then going into politics, going against the establishment, when I actually ran for San Diego City Council when I was a Bernie supporter, they ousted me because I was a Bernie supporter, and then they supported the person who was supporting Hillary at the time. So even going to convention, dealing with being the minority and during that entire progressive movement that Bernie started in 2016, having to deal with that as well, of being the outsider and not dealing and not playing by the rules by way the party says they were supposed to be. My entire life has been a giant opposition to everything that exists. So that's kind of what developed me as a human, as a person that's going to go against the system with courage, because that's all I've been doing my entire life.
All right. Well, Jose, we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to hear more about specific policy proposals that you support. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Jose Caballero, who is running for Congress in California's 53rd district, in just a moment. Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking to progressive candidate Jose Caballero out of California's 53rd district. So, Jose, in the last segment, you told us about the 53rd district, which is a district that is one of the most populous in California, consists of a strong contingency of Bernie Sanders supporters. The greatest concentration of donors in the country is in your district, consists of a significant military vet contingency. San Diego, of course, a lot of particularly Navy presence, but others, and a large Latino population in the district. And you certainly have had experiences and share the ideas and the experiences with folks from all of those different and sometimes I would imagine overlapping backgrounds. But let's talk about the specific issue sets that you are running here, and why it's your sense that this is going to appeal to folks in the 53rd.
Absolutely. And, you know, the ones that are, you know, the progressive major issues, Medicare for all, Green New Deal, education for all, student loan debt forgiveness, and bringing the troops home with dignity. Those are the major issues that we're focusing on. But we actually have a litany of different policies. But I really wanted to focus in heavily on the Heroes Promise. Now, the Heroes Promise is a military veteran bill of rights that I have authored that basically is there to address and end veteran suicide, because we're losing 20 veterans a day. Now, let me put this in perspective for you. So since 9/11, we have lost on around 139,000 vets by their own hand in suicide. It is one of the biggest epidemics that we are facing in this country, and we are not doing a thing about it. And it was actually one of the biggest reasons why I decided to run as well, because when Representative Davis was part of this district, she was the ranking member of the Armed Forces Committee, and nothing was being done. So I want to pass a comprehensive bill that actually addresses all the major issues of transition and also deals with the traumas that exist within the military inherently, like meal and sleep protection, the right to file a grievance, the right to mental health services. Because as a nuke, as a reactor operator, if I went and saw a therapist and got prescribed antidepressants, I lose my job. I can't operate a reactor anymore. Losing my career. And we need to give people the option to seek mental health without reprisal of losing their careers and their livelihood. We need to have an end-of-service pension for our vets to make sure, like, for example, for up to 6 years, a time match. So if you serve 4 years, you'll get 4 years of pension of your base pay and every month. That is something that's going to help people transition into the economy without having the fear of having to go and get, a 9-to-5 little, a retail job just so you can make ends meet. And if you have a family, sometimes that exit isn't available because then they lose those benefits. So we need to make sure that we provide that economic stability for these vets. And then on the veteran side, once they're out, we got to get housing for all vets, healthcare for all veterans, citizenship for all veterans, and education for all veterans. These are the things that we need to provide our veterans with, no question asked, because these are the things that will affect people in the long term, because we should not allow 4 years of your life to determine the rest of your life. And that's what's happening to most of our vets. 4 years of your life, and then 10 years later, they're still trying to hold down the job, And those are the things that are the problem.
Jose, yeah. I want to get to some of the other stuff, and I think, folks obviously can head to your website, josefforcongress.us. Yeah. To find more of the issues. I mean, you tick them off. You were a full-on Bernie supporter. I think people can, glean at least from that what your issue set is. But this number, yeah. I mean, the idea that we're losing a vet every 65 minutes or so in this country is stunning. And now, to be clear, is there a way to make an apples and apples comparison with vets of other wars? I mean, we're coming out of Iraq. Martin Luther King, I think, said famously, every time there's an explosion in Vietnam, or a bomb is dropped in Vietnam, it explodes here. And largely that was also like the implications of what we're doing to the people that we send on these wars. So, I mean, I wonder, is there do we have a particularly unique problem, or do we just do a worse job of taking care of our people?
Well, we have a unique problem because we are in so many wars, right? So we send more personnel to wars than any other country does. And then it's a inadequate problem because of the fact that we still have vets on the street. Like, you can see the fact that when you walk and drive down San Diego, 1 in 4 people are veterans. Right. And that is unbelievable to think about. Right. So we are allowing our veterans to be on the street. We are turning away veterans when they're seeking mental health. We are turning away veterans when they want to go to high level educational institutions. We're turning away veterans if they want to seek master's and PhDs because they lose their benefits after 36 months of in school time. So we are scratching the surface of what needs to be done for these veterans. And when you look at other countries, they actually give a ton of respect and a ton of benefits to all of their veterans in those countries. Now, we could say that, well, we just have more veterans than most of the world, so therefore we'd have to put in more money. Well, that doesn't stop the defense contractors from asking for billions and billions of dollars every year. The fact that we've had a defense budget of around $325 billion the year after 9/11, but now we're sitting at $700 billion, yet the personnel haven't gotten those raises at the level that they should be. The personnel haven't also got those benefits when they get out. But we've been making plenty of bombs, planes, and tanks and ships. We need to change the narrative and say, look, if we're going to be increasing these defense budgets, we need to make sure that predominantly of that money goes to the vets when they come home so they can be safe when they get here.
Well, Jose, we're out of time, but if folks want more information, they can go to josefforcongress.us. No, it's an incredibly important issue. You are obviously very attuned to it, and it's obviously one that resonates within your district. Folks can go check out your support for the Green New Deal, for student loan debt forgiveness, for criminal justice reform, education for all, and more at your website. joseforcongress.us, and we will put that link on Ring of Fire Radio. Jose, thanks so much for your time today, and good luck in your race.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Jose Caballero is running for Congress in California's 53rd District. You can find out more about Jose on his website, joseforcongress.us. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We're continuing our interview series with progressive candidates from across the country. This week, we feature Jessica Scarane, who is running for U.S. Senate in Delaware against Chris Coons for the Democratic nomination. So, Jessica, I mean, for folks that don't have a sense about the state of Delaware, give us a sense of it. I mean, I know you live in Wilmington, and that is distinct in many respects from Delaware as well. But give us a sense about who you have to appeal to in this state if you are going to defeat Chris Coons in this primary.
Sure. So I'm sure people know it's a pretty small state. We have fewer than a million people here. But in a lot of ways, it's a state that's in some ways a microcosm of the country. We have dense city populations. We have rural and farms. We have suburbs and we have the beaches. So we have a really diverse state as far as the types of communities that we have here. But it's also a state where we have really drastic wealth inequality. We have really poor, under-resourced neighborhoods that are just 2 miles away from historically very wealthy neighborhoods that have been around since the DuPonts first kind of put their stake here in Delaware. So what we're looking at is who are the people who have been Bernie voters in 2016, Kerry Evelyn Harris voters in 2018, who have become the base of the progressive push here in our state? And who are the people who are feeling really disenfranchised or disengaged based on the choices that they've been presented for years now? That there really has been limited choice in Delaware. It's not a state that has a lot of primaries to incumbents. It's very uncommon, and it takes a lot of courage for someone like Kerry Evelyn Harris last year to do that, and for the many candidates that are doing that this year. So we want to look at those voters too, those people who haven't felt like voting makes a difference because their life doesn't materially change no matter who's in that seat. So that's where we are focusing our strategy, is getting out voters who are younger, who are less engaged, and who are already bought into this progressive agenda that we're putting forward.
So when we're talking about a state this size, I mean, you know, they're... I'm in a city with more people probably within a 5-10 mile radius. What is its history in terms of electing Republicans? In other words, I know it's a D6 state, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. which is basically the Democrats have a 6-point advantage on day one, if you will, relative mm-hmm. to any generic Republican. But what are the implications of winning the primary, I guess, is what I want to say, in terms of the general election for the Senate there?
I think the prospects are good. I don't think that we would be jeopardizing a Democratic seat. As you mentioned, it is a blue state here. Our voter registration skews Democratic drastically. The state has had largely Democratic representation for decades now. So I don't think that we're not necessarily presenting a concern about disrupting the ability to have a Democrat in representing us in the Senate.
Okay. And I ask that because, you know, obviously that's a big question that people have in terms of primaries. How much are we jeopardizing this seat? Obviously, every seat in the Senate is really important. Now, with that said, I would be less than forthcoming if I didn't say that I was very much hoping that somebody would primary Chris Coons for a myriad of reasons. And I want to get obviously to the list of issues that you support in a bit, because I think there, you know, obviously people should have positive reasons to vote. But when we're talking about voting for a challenger mm-hmm. against incumbent, I think there has to be a case as to why the incumbent is not necessarily serving their constituency well. And now I have about a half dozen reasons of my own about Chris Coons, and we've been mostly talking to challengers of Congress people, and I generally don't have this many reasons, but mm-hmm. let's hear yours. I mean, specifically in terms of Chris Coons, where is Chris Coons failing the people of Delaware?
Yeah, the core point here, there are quite a few contrasts that I'm drawing, right? I am looking to run a campaign that is people-centric. I want a government that puts our people at its core and legislates for the people. And we have a senator right now who is not focused on that. He has taken hundreds of thousands of dollars from industries like big pharma, and then directly starts working on bills that are going to benefit those industries. So he's working on a bill right now to do quote unquote patent reform. But what that is doing is actually putting stronger patents in the hands of pharmaceutical companies, preventing generic competition and creating higher prices for Delawareans. So when I look at things like that, I see a senator who's not fighting for the people of Delaware. I look at things like lack of commitment to economic justice, things like saying minimum wage, raising it to $15, that it wouldn't necessarily be, it would be too much money for places in even our state. And we know that that's not true. We know that to have a median run-of-the-mill sort of average one-bedroom apartment, you need to be making at least $18 in our state to be able to afford that without overtaxing yourself. So he's not even clued into the experience that voters have in our state. And on top of that, he really seems to have bipartisanship in his mind as the end game. And I don't inherently have a problem with bipartisanship or compromise, but when I see that done at the expense of Delawareans, that's when I start to recognize that there has to be something beyond bipartisanship that we are fighting for. It can't be simply about making that compromise. An example of this is last year when he worked with Jeff Flake during the Kavanaugh hearings to fight for this FBI investigation. And then he and Jeff Flake went on this tour on television talking about this compromise while the FBI completely failed to conduct a thorough investigation of the claims that were against Brett Kavanaugh. And those are the things that Chris Coons has been doing, like rubber stamping a lot of Trump judges. He's voted for more than 80 of them, many of which who are anti-choice and anti-women's rights and civil rights and have not confirmed their support for things like Brown versus Board of Education. He has confirmed many of Trump's appointees, including people like Kirstjen Nielsen, who is no longer in the job after she was defending the camps that exist at our borders right now. People like Alex Azar, who is a drug company lobbyist and former drug company executive who is now running Health and Human Services. And he wants to position himself as a centrist that can make deals, but in reality, it ends up just pulling him to the right side and not fighting for the people of Delaware.
You know, I know that Politico magazine called him the, quote, the GOP's favorite Democrat. And I'm glad you brought up that notion of a supposed bipartisanship. Very often, in my experience, and I've been watching this stuff for 15 years, that is often a fig leaf to promote, like you say, a corporate agenda. When Chris Coons is already talking about, after Mitch McConnell has basically just turned the Senate into a factory to confirm right-wing judges. They have confirmed more judges almost in 3 years under Trump than they did under 8 years under Obama on the circuit court. Mm-hmm. When Chris Coons says he wants to bring back the filibuster if the Democrats take control, that to me is a sign that this guy does not want Democrats to be able to influence our government in the way that Republicans have. And I understand if you come from Montana or something, and this is your disposition, but this is a state that is, like we said earlier, a Democratic leaning state by over 6 points. All right. We have to take a break. When we come back, Jessica, I want to talk about, your proactive proposals, because not only is there a problem, I believe, with Chris Coons that is fairly, distinct. Right. It's not just his voting record. It's the fact that, you know, from a process standpoint, he is using Republicans to stand in the way of progress. You also have an issue set that I think people are going to really appreciate. We got to take a quick break. Mm-hmm. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back after this on Ring of Fire Radio. Back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking to progressive candidate for the U.S. Senate in Delaware, Jessica Scorain. So, Jessica, in the last segment, we talked about what the nature of Delaware and, frankly, the shortcomings of Chris Coons, who is a U.S. senator. And this is why I think, you know, to a large extent, it is important for a national audience to hear from you, because Chris Coons obviously is a senator, but he's one of those people who's talking about, let's bring back the filibuster if the Democrats attain power. In other words, let's give the Republicans the right to inhibit our ability to in some way mitigate the damage that has been done by the Republicans to our judiciary over the past 10 years because of their obstruction under Obama. This is also a guy, and I do want to get to your issue set because it's a great one as far as I'm concerned. This is always a guy who is also on record as saying that he thinks some of the partisan rancor is a function of, frankly, having a diverse set of senators. I don't know if you caught that. I imagine you have. How important it is to you, obviously you're running as a person who supports things like universal health care and housing as a right and combating climate change and economic justice. But, I mean, tell me your thoughts about the question of diversity. Do you think that's the problem as to why there's such polarization in our politics?
I think that it is not necessarily diversity that is causing polarization. I think it is a top versus bottom struggle. And people on the bottom are recognizing that they don't feel supported by their government, and that's what they want to see. I think that when you look at the current Senate, you certainly don't see it representing the people of America. And that is something that I think needs to change, because that is why it's not representing the right type of legislation or working in a way to help the people of America. Delaware is a state that has actually never had a female senator. It's never had an African-American senator or Hispanic senator. We have only had men in that seat both of those seats for the history of our state. So that doesn't look like our state. So that I do think is something that, while important, it is not the only thing that I am obviously running on, but I think it's important to call out that, yeah, we've tried these same types of people with the same types of experience, and this is where we've gotten. So if we want different results, we need different people. We need different types of experience.
So let's talk about the issues you support. What sits atop your agenda as a senator from Delaware?
Well, I want to talk one bit about Chris Coons on that before I get there, because I am putting forth a pretty progressive platform, and I will talk about it. And he is someone who has called these plans, literally used the words wild-eyed and referred to them as irrational. He is actively working against progressive initiatives right now in the Senate, I assume because he's expecting to see a President Sanders or a President Warren. And he is working with the Budget Committee to pass budget austerity rules that would automatically trigger austerity based on government spending. And that is something that is going to inhibit our ability to put forth the progressive agenda that we want to see. So this is someone who's teaming up with Republicans, again, celebrating their bipartisanship and celebrating coming to an agreement, but at the cost to who? At the cost to people like us who need better services and better programs from our government. And some of those better services and programs that I want to see are, there's five core pieces that I'm running on. One, universal health care. That's Medicare for all, completely comprehensive, no premiums, no deductibles, no copays. You go to the doctor for medical, dental, vision, mental health care, and you leave free at the point of service. We need to lower the price of prescription drugs. We need to be able to negotiate with the drug companies. We need to find ways to break the monopolies that these drug companies have to lower prices and provide patients with more options. I want the federal government to be focused on equitable education. I think our federal government's lack of priority of education and funding behind education has put our states in a position where they are hamstrung and they're unable to create equal systems, because the only tool that they really have at their disposal are property taxes, which are inherently unequal. So the government needs to be committed to free public education from childcare and pre-K all the way through higher education, trade school, two-year college, four-year college, whatever that might be for that student. We know that a high school education is not setting people up for success anymore. We need to make sure that we are progressing our education system with where our workforce is going as well. We need to cancel student debt, which is completely hamstrung an entire generation. And we need to make sure that our schools have funding for the wraparound services that actually make them core strengths, strong points in a neighborhood. So that's things like free meals so that hunger isn't a barrier to education, classroom supplies, nurses, counselors, social workers. These are things that we know schools are lacking, but they make a difference in a child's education. I also believe housing is a right. As I mentioned earlier, it's expensive to live in Delaware. It's not New York or San Francisco, it's Seattle. It's not hitting the headlines, but it's expensive to live here. And all we are seeing right now is development in that luxury tier that only very wealthy people can afford. So we need a federal investment in housing programs so that we can eradicate homelessness in this country. We are the richest country in the world. No one should be going without a safe and affordable home. It is integral to living in this country and surviving in this country. Combating climate change, I would sign on to the Green New Deal, transform our energy system, end the extraction of fossil fuels. I'm sorry, finally, just economic justice. I recognize that this is a top versus bottom fight here. We need to make sure that our government is representing working people and fighting to make sure that no one is struggling in our country. No one here should be too poor to live.
So, Jessica, walk us through, just a little bit about you. We have about 2 minutes left here, but just tell us a little bit about yourself. What qualifies you? I mean, aside from having a platform that I think a lot of people support and your opponent not supporting if much of it, what qualifies you to run? And what do you need to do to beat a guy like Chris Coons in the primary?
Yeah. So my drive here is seeing in my work as a board president of a nonprofit here is that I had to go up against our government to ensure that our state government didn't cut nonprofit funding when it had a budget gap. And that was really eye-opening to me that even when we have these services, which we only have because the government fails to provide them, but even when we have them, we know they're not guaranteed. And that is what has exposed me to a different type of experience than we have seen in senators. And I think the qualification should be, do you understand how people live? Do you understand the problems that people are facing in our country? And can you put forth ideas and programs that are going to make it better for people and change their outlook and standard of living in life? As far as what I think it's going to take for us to win, there was a poll released just today by Data for Progress that shows Coons is trailing a generic, more liberal candidate. And when people get exposed to his record, that gap grows even further. So that's our strategy. It is get out on as many doors. We are planning to knock more doors than has ever been knocked in the state. Just last week, we had 20 people out in December in 40-degree weather, which is a lot of people for Delaware, especially this early. And we are going to make sure that we are on the doors, hearing from people, bringing their ideas into our policies, and bringing that vision forward. So not only are we saying, here's what's actually happening with your representative in Washington right now, and here's how we believe it can be different.
When is the primary?
It is September 15th, 2020.
September 15th, 2020. So you got about 10 months to get volunteers, donations. Folks can head to your website. Why don't you give it to us now?
Sure. It's justfordelaware.com. If they head to justfordelaware.com/donate, they can make donations. Obviously, that's really important for us coming up on the filing deadline. We are only 3 weeks into this campaign, so we haven't had a lot of this quarter. So we are really looking to push towards the end of the year to show people that there's support and power behind this campaign.
Jessica Scarane, I wish you all the luck in the world, and I'm so glad that Chris Coons is getting a primary race this year. And again, good luck.
Thanks so much for the time, Sam.
Jessica Scarane is running for Senate in Delaware. You can find out more about Jessica's campaign over at jessfordelaware.com. That's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Next week, we'll have a brand new show to kick off 2020. And it's going to be a crazy year, folks. Thanks for supporting the show. I'm Sam Cedar. I'll see you next week. All my-